International businesses are reconsidering their operations in Myanmar. Live from London, this is the Marketplace Morning Report from the BBC World Service. I'm Victoria Craig. Good morning. More than 700 people have died in violent protests across Myanmar since the nation's military seized control from the democratically elected government back in February. Foreign companies are finding themselves in a tricky position, worrying about employee safety, business prospects, and public pressure to stop doing business with the military. A high-end office block in Yangon linked to military leaders is now seeing an exodus of international organizations. Coca-Cola, the World Bank, and consultancy McKinsey told the BBC they've moved out or are reviewing their leases at the complex. The BBC's Saranjana Tiwari explains this was not the future many foreign companies imagined there.
10 years ago, the country got its first democratically elected government. And since then, we've really seen an opening up of the country when these foreign firms have been able to come in and invest and start operations. Companies like Kirin Beer, H&M, Adani, Telenor, Coca-Cola. And the way that they were set up was they had to run joint ventures with the military, with state-run enterprises. Now, one theory that this entire coup was designed to protect the military's wealth and business interests because the civilian government was becoming a bit too powerful.
So these businesses originally sought to do business there after the nation gained independence in 1948. I guess, why was investment so attractive then?
You know, it was obviously a new country in a sense because it had been under military rule for so long and there were lots of people there who needed services or products and also lots of resources in the country. Myanmar is also in the center of a number of countries geographically. So big energy giants like Total, they actually provide electricity to parts of Thailand as well. And for them, this has really become a dilemma because if they pull out of the country, people won't get basic services like electricity.
And that's sort of the other point, isn't it? It's not all about advantages for businesses. It's that this investment has also had an effect on ordinary citizens' lives all over, too.
Absolutely. And that's the real dilemma that these companies are in. Now, one thing that one company, a South Korean company called POSCO, has done is it's suspended its revenues and dividend payments to the military to kind of act as a sanction to the military and send a message that they're not happy with how things are going. That also means there might be some sort of interruption to the services and they might have to decide whether they stay in the country or they pull out.
So if they leave, what other kinds of companies might take their place?
Well, there's, of course, the state-run companies, and that's something that campaigners, they don't want those companies to get more power and more investment. But there's also China. Lots of analysts and experts do say that even if these foreign companies do withdraw, then China is just waiting in the wings. Myanmar is part of the Belt and Road Initiative, and so China is absolutely ready to do that.
Has any of that already started to happen in these early days?
Yeah, we've seen China reaffirm its ties with Myanmar. We've also seen Myanmar has announced new investment of projects worth nearly $2.8 billion, including a big LNG plant. And it's safe to say that Chinese companies are certainly going to be interested in helping with those kinds of investment. But there's also a lot of things like banks who are lending to companies that are continuing to work with the military, HSBC and Standard Chartered, for example. Also, there's a company called Adani, an Indian firm that's invested in Myanmar. The Australian government is very invested in Adani, and they are continuing to build a state-funded port. So where do you draw the line of how invested foreign companies are in Myanmar? Is it operations or is it investments?
The BBC's Saranjana Tiwari for us. Thanks so much for this insight.
Thank you for having me.
Checking the numbers now, European benchmarks are taking a breather after yesterday's sell-off. London's FTSE 100 is up about 0.5% after fresh data here showed the economy grew 2.1% in March. That's as the nation emerged from a tough three-month lockdown. Meanwhile, stocks across Asia were largely mixed. Investors there perhaps eyeing new research from the American Chamber of Commerce Hong Kong, which shows more than 40% of its business members are considering moving out of the Asian financial hub. A majority cited concerns over new national security laws Beijing imposed last year and worry about Hong Kong's future competitiveness. When Australia's Treasurer this week unveiled a spending spree budget designed to further support the COVID-19 recovery, he declared the economy is roaring back to life. But not included in his plans is a roadmap for reopening Australia's borders. They're likely to remain shut until the middle of next year, and that's now prompting the nation's flag carrier, Qantas, to delay its own plans for resuming international operations. That all begs a bigger question. Will business travel ever be the booming business we once knew? The BBC's Manuela Sarah Grossa has been finding out.
My last work trip was in California. I'm in Boston, so that's a good flight.
Before COVID hit, Juliette Cayenne there used to be a frequent business traveler. Her job as professor at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government and her previous position as former assistant secretary at the U.S. Department of Homeland Security meant she was in demand to speak at events around America and across the world.
There's parts of it I miss. I mean, I'm definitely one of these people who's like rethinking what parts of my life should change because of the pandemic. But I also miss the independence of travel.
Whether companies and organizations will still want to pay for meetings to happen in person is key to the future of business travel. And what happens to business travel matters for the whole of the travel industry, because corporate travel is where the biggest profit margins are. The signs, though, are not good. The Financial Times reported that as the COVID pandemic recedes, Europe's largest banks are planning to slash business travel permanently by as much as half from pre-pandemic levels. And industry consultant Scott Gillespie reckons the pandemic has made corporations everywhere rethink the purpose of corporate travel.
Senior management is clearly, I'll say, confounded. They have seen for the last year that they can do virtually no business travel, and many businesses have still succeeded. I'm not sure how the major network airlines are going to succeed at recovering as much of the travel as they had in 2019. I just don't see how they're going to do it.
And don't the airlines know it?
I think it's fair to manage the expectations that there will be structural changes in terms of business travel.
Jeffrey Goh is chief executive of the Star Alliance, the world's largest airline group, which includes Singapore Airlines, United Airlines, and Thai and Swiss Air, among others.
We are getting much more savvy now with much more advanced applications like Teams and Zoom and WebEx. And that's why I think it's fair to plan for a change. And I think the industry is looking at 20%, 30%.
A reduction in trade at that sort of level would be hard for the travel industry to weather. But environmentalists point out one silver lining, which is that less demand for business travel would significantly reduce the aviation sector's contribution to global greenhouse gas emissions. I'm the BBC's Manuela Zaragoza for Marketplace.
And one final bit of news for you. The European Union's second highest court has overturned an order from the European Commission for $303 million in back taxes from Amazon. In 2017, the Commission accused Luxembourg of extending tax privileges, which it said counted as illegal state aid. In London, I'm Victoria Craig with the Marketplace Morning Report from the BBC World Service.